Okay, so I'm not sure why I heard this story the first time, and I think I've even told this, but I've been here 9 years, so I think I can start reusing some of my stories. Chippy the parakeet never really saw it coming. One second he was peacefully perched in his cage, the next he was sucked in, washed up, and blown over. The problem began when Chippy's owner decided to clean up Chippy's cage with a vacuum cleaner. She removed the attachment from the end of the hose, and I think we should note that it says she removed the attachment from the end of the hose, and we know where this is going. Anyway, she removed the attachment from the end of the hose, stuck it in the cage. The phone rang, and she turned to pick it up, and she barely said hello when Chippy got sucked into the vacuum. The bird owner gasped, put down the phone, turned off the vacuum, opened the bag. And there's Chippy, still alive, but stunned. And since the bird was covered in dust and soot, she grabs him and races to the bathroom, turns on the faucet, and holds Chippy underneath the water. Then, realizing that Chippy was soaked and shriveling, she did what any compassionate bird owner would do. She reached for the hairdryer and blasted the pet with hot air. Poor Chippy never knew what hit him. A few days after the trauma, the person who initially had written about the event contacted Chippy's owner to see how the bird was recovering. And she said, well, Chippy doesn't really sing much anymore. He just sits there and stares. It's hard not to understand why. I mean, sucked in, washed up, blown over, that's enough to really steal the song from the strongest of hearts. And the whole point is, this is technology again, playing in, you know, to somebody's life and not working the way you want it to, right? Vacuum cleaners or iPads or whatever. And these are all trials, and those are minor. Granted, these are minor trials I'm talking about. But trials in our lives can be traumatic. You may feel like Chippy sometimes. We all been there. Too many things going on in our lives, and we're just like, I can't deal with one more. I'm just done. But as David wrote in the Psalms, our problems can also draw us closer to the Lord. Psalm 119, verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. The same psalm in verse 71, it is good for me that I was afflicted. It is good for me that I went through a trial, that I might learn your statutes. Those verses indicate that the main purpose of any affliction is for God to be glorified in it, or maybe even through it. He may allow a trial in your life so that the Lord would be glorified by you. That puts a whole new perspective on trials in our lives, right? Think about John chapter 9, verse 3. This is the man born blind. And the disciples see this man, and they turn to Jesus, and who sinned, this guy or his parents? Because then it was considered if you had some horrible thing going on in your life, you know, you were sick or, you know, poverty or anything like that, it was because you were sinful. And his disciples were just asking. And Jesus says in John 9, verse 3, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. This man in John's gospel is born blind 30 years prior. So in this one moment down the road, the Messiah walks along and sees this man and heals him. God allows hardships in a believer's life so that he can develop our faith by showing that his grace is sufficient for our most difficult trials. We must have certainty in knowing that nothing is too great for him. We can believe that he'll see everything through that appears hopeless. Or he'll see us through everything that appears hopeless. The text today is about a woman who had been hemorrhaging, who had a bleeding issue for 12 years. And then a 12-year-old girl who's raised from the dead. Well, 12 years is a common element to both of them. But perhaps even more significant is the common elements in both situations. And those elements are desperation and a fledgling faith, or a new faith. On the one hand, you'll see Jesus focus on a woman who's been suffering from a disastrous hemorrhage for 12 years. This would have made her ritually unclean and unable to have a simple relationship with anyone, because anyone she came in contact with or touched would have been considered unclean as well and would not be able to participate in the wider community. If she'd been married, she was likely divorced by now. If she had a family, she would not have been able to be around them. She was ostracized from normal society and banned from even worshiping in the temple. In marked contrast is the prominent family of Jairus. Jairus is considered a ruler of the synagogue. He was a powerful man of high stature, a man of substantial prestige, but he was in equally desperate need because his 12-year-old daughter was dying. Here we have two separate representations of life. One was well off, the other is poor. One's accepted, the other is excluded. One was with family and loved ones, and the other one was alone. But both are in a situation where they're beyond human help. For 12 years, the girl and the woman had led completely different lives. But now, in their adversity, they would both be recipients of God's life-giving power. This would be true even though both situations involve fledgling, imperfect faith. And we'll see Jesus develop that. This is the story about a man, his daughter, a woman, but really it's the story about Jesus, who the book of Hebrews identifies as the author and perfecter of our faith, doing just that for these two people. We begin in Luke 8, verses 40 and 42. Now when Jesus returned, this is returning to Capernaum, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler in the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. And as Jesus went, the people pressed around him. So Jesus is just returning from a place where, if you remember last week, what did the people want to do with him? They wanted him to leave. Get out of here. We don't even want you around. They were pretty upset about all the pigs drowning in the Sea of Galilee. And when Jesus returned to Capernaum, the people are thrilled to have him home because he's done all these miracles there over the last several months, and they're happy to have him around because there's a new trick, a new circus. And this vast crowd swarmed the shore to greet him and to see what other miracles he might do. And this is described as a dangerous, jostling, noisy crowd. And is silenced momentarily by this extraordinary spectacle because prostrated before Jesus was this leader of the synagogue. When it says ruler of the synagogue, meant likely a rabbi or somebody who was in charge of it, a highly honored man who was groveling at Jesus' feet, pleading with Jesus to come and heal his dying daughter. Jairus had not been known to be friendly towards Jesus. He no doubt knew that Jesus had been accused of heresy by other synagogues. Controversy had already happened in this synagogue here in Capernaum. So Jairus' huge sign of submission and humility to Jesus was indeed amazing. And please remember that by this time, the rest of the Jewish religious leaders, what they were doing was plotting to kill Jesus. So we cannot suppose that Jairus had become a sudden devotee of Jesus, or that he was a man of strong faith. The fact was that Jairus is just desperate. No doubt he had heard of Jesus' miracles, maybe he had even seen some, and possibly had met some who had been healed. He was probably not at all sure about Jesus. But Jesus was his only chance now, and this is what he's left with. So with this bare flicker of faith, he falls prostrate. And Jairus was like so many who have come to Christ. It wasn't his love for Christ that brought him. It was not what he hoped to do for Christ. It was simply desperation and a glimmer of hope. Despair is commonly the prelude to grace. Jesus responded to Jairus' urgent plea by immediately starting out to go with him. But as you see in the second part of verse 12, there was this huge crowd that impeded each and every step. And the word for pressed or pressed around him is the word supnego, which means to almost suffocate them. So this is a crowd that's, you can't even move in it. You can barely breathe in it. If you got stuck in this mob, you've had difficulty doing much of anything. because of the pushing and the shoving of the people. But we're about to see that Jesus isn't flustered. He's not bothered by any of this, because he knows he's going to get to Jairus' house in God's good time. Because God is always right on time. His ways are perfect. He orders the sun, the moon, and stars in their journeys with mathematical precision, so that we can foretell to the very moment when the sun will rise, the phases of the moon, and the appearance of a comet. And then problems show up. Verse 43, and there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. To Jairus' awful dismay, everything comes to a halt. For there's another desperate person there that day. An unknown woman with a hemorrhage. As if his frustration with the multitude wasn't enough, now comes this, just another distraction. And actually, what we would call a distraction or an interruption was for Jesus always a springboard or a taking off point for something else. What for us would have been a painful interruption is to him just a golden opportunity. It's easy to view interruptions as distractions from real life, especially when we're in a hurry. And we're always in a hurry, aren't we? How often do you and I miss some of God's best opportunities? But then, since interruptions are unavoidable, as much as we hate to admit it, maybe we would be wise to build into our schedules some extra room for the interruptions, the distractions. Maybe we need to learn and apply this truth, because God's mission cannot ultimately be defeated. The twists and the turns in your path are very often our opportunities to show the personal care for individuals that bears witness to God's care for each of us. Verse 44 and 45, this woman, she came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, who was it that touched me? When all denied it, Peter said, Master, the crowd surround you and are pressing in on you. This woman is determined to get to Jesus, even though she was taking a big risk of being caught by someone who knew about her condition. This would result in her being shamed and removed from the crowd. But she took her chances in this desperate desire to reach Christ. With this somewhat deficient faith, she believed if she could just touch the hem of his garment, then maybe she would be healed. And not wanting to be noticed, she came up behind Jesus. And how she got through this mob, you don't really know. In some places, she may have needed to crawl. But she got up to him and touched the border of his garment. In some translation, it says that she touched the tassel of his robe. And years of agony and embarrassment were reversed in that one brief touch. The poor woman had done her best to escape notice. She came in when everybody was singing. She went into the back and hides in the back so nobody sees her. She wouldn't touch him because she didn't want to contaminate him or make him unclean. She would just touch a part of his garment. And the moment she made contact, she's healed. Power flows from Christ to this woman, and new life from Christ coursed through her veins. And the greatness of this woman's faith consisted in this, that she believed that the power of Christ to heal was so amazing that even the mere touch of his clothes would result in an instant and complete cure. That this faith was deficient, or by no means perfect, appears from the fact that she thought that such an actual touch was necessary, that Jesus would never notice it. But imperfect though her faith was, the Lord still rewards it. And recovery is instant. In one brief moment, the hemorrhage stops completely. Health and vigor began to surge through every part of her body. And this is verse 46 through 48. But Jesus said, someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me. And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. So in all this pushing and shoving in crowdedness, Jesus all of a sudden makes the unusual statement to Peter, "Who touched me?" Because everybody was touching him. Everybody's bumping into him and bumping into each other. But he sensed something was different. Luke says that all denied touching him. Peter thought Jesus' statement is kind of unusual, isn't the word. Probably looked at him like he had three heads, went, "What do you mean, who touched you? Everybody's touching you." He's basically saying, with all these people, what do you mean who? The Lord was not ignorant of who touched him. And that's, you need to understand this. It's not that Jesus is saying, "Gosh, I don't really know who touched me." The reason this question is asked was not for the Lord's benefit, but to encourage the woman who touched him to confess what happened to her. He wanted the woman to step forward and identify herself. Among other things, Jesus wanted to teach her that his robe didn't contain magical properties, but that her faith in him had healed her. But there are also other good reasons for why Jesus wanted this woman to publicly confess what she did. If she had honestly crept away into the crowd, she would not have met Jesus personally or heard his words of assurance or comfort that follow. Her confession was also an encouragement to Jairus, who's still laying in the dirt at Jesus' feet, who would have soon heard in this passage that his daughter had died. And perhaps in that moment he wanted to blame this woman because she's the one that held things up. The woman's 12 years of trial were ended, and the same Christ who helped her would help Jairus. And she, this woman, is a testimony to the power of faith. True, she didn't exercise great faith. It was pretty small, insignificant faith. But Christ honored it and healed her body. Finally, I think that Jesus wanted her to be identified so that everyone would know that this woman is no longer to be treated as unclean. Basically, you can allow her to rejoin society. Jesus is being merciful to her, and Jesus was perfecting this woman's faith. You see, she also had a selfish faith because she wanted health, but she didn't really especially care about the healer. This is common to everyone when they start out with faith. We come to Christ because of some problem we have. We reach out in stumbling faith amidst the press of the crowd, but recognizing a genuine yearning and trust, Jesus still touches us with his love. And he perfects our fledgling, immature faith. After Christ had coaxed the trembling woman forward, she made her confession. He said, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." His explanation that her faith had healed her informed her that it wasn't some superstition about his clothes, not some kind of magic, but her faith that put her in touch with God. And in establishing this personal relationship with her, Jesus demonstrated that we cannot be saved by the power of Christ without coming into a relationship with him as a person. This desperate woman represents all of us, all of humanity, because we're all ill. We spend our money for things that don't work. But when Christ comes to us, we need to touch him by faith. We can't fear that he won't respond. And we can't fear that we're too ignorant or too not worthy, or that we're too selfish. We should fear only one thing, that we would let him pass without responding in faith and reaching out to him. Verse 49, while Jesus was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said to Jairus, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." Someone came to Jairus and told him she was dead, and it was no use in bringing Jesus to the house. You're wasting your time. He wasn't to trouble or annoy Jesus. And people adopt the same attitude today. When they feel there's no solution to their problems, they don't feel that the Lord can do anything for them. And they sit there and they're like, Why even bother? Why bother praying? Not only was his daughter dead, but also all of Jairus' hope was dead as well. All that he could do now was arrange for the funeral. The Lord heard the sad news and read Jairus' despair, and he says to him, "Fear not, believe and she will be well." This gets you to Luke 8, verse 50. But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe and she will be well." And Jesus heard the report to Jairus, and the Lord responds with these words of comfort. In that moment when his hope has died, everything is just going black. Jesus still offers that little sliver of hope, because these aren't empty words. Because the Lord knows more than you think he knows. And he's aware of our situations, just as he's aware of Jairus' situation. Jesus tells his hurting father that everything's going to be okay. The tense of that verse, "fear not," means basically the Lord forbids Jairus not to be afraid anymore, but to believe in him and his daughter would be made well. In other words, she would be restored to life, to health. The faith called for here is a confidence about God's power and his compassion and his ability to deliver the child out of death. You don't want to miss the providential arrangement here. Jairus came to Jesus with an uninformed, wishful, quasi-belief that Jesus could heal his daughter. That belief was being perfected and elevated through Jesus' delay in dealing with the woman who reached out and touched him. Because he made Jairus wait until his daughter was dead to do anything, makes it that much more powerful what he does. You'll see this again when you get into John's gospel. He's informed that his friend, his best friend, Lazarus is dying. And he says, "Okay, well, we're going to wait 4 days. Then we're going to do something." Because to do it now isn't as big a deal. So back in our story, now Christ is challenging Jairus to not merely believe in him for a healing, but now for his daughter's resurrection from the dead. Did Jairus believe this when he was told this? It's kind of hard not to believe it after he'd just seen what had happened for this woman. Otherwise, he and Jesus and the three disciples would never have returned to his home and entered the room of his daughter. This takes us up to 51 through 55. "And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, 'Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping.' And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, 'Child, arise.' And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat." Now, that passage is a little tough to follow because we're not sure who's talking and what's going on if you read too fast. But Luke tells us that no one was allowed to go into the house except the parents and Peter and James and John. In fact, Mark tells us that in Mark's version of this episode, it says that Jesus put everyone else out. Now, everyone else that was there would have been the professional mourners that showed up to wail and cry in the streets and make this big production out of this girl being dead. This phrase, "put them out," is from the word ekbalo, which means he cast them or drove them out of the house. It's the same word that's used to talk about the moneylenders in the temple later on in his ministry when he makes whips and drives them out of the temple. He wasn't nice about it, because he didn't like that false grief, that false religion that the Jews had come up with over the centuries. The words means he used force. He literally threw them out of the house. And they weren't going to be witnesses of a great miracle of the raising of the dead. Mocking Christ does not increase your blessings, it decreases them. Mark also informs that this noisy group, the mourners, laughed and ridiculed and scorned Jesus when he told them she was sleeping. And they made personal attacks against him. The mourners failed to realize that Christ had raised the widow's son at Nain from the dead earlier. The disciples of John the Baptist were told to tell him that they had seen the dead being raised by Jesus. So Jesus had already done this multiple times. And apparently the mourners didn't believe these reports and thought Jesus was a fool. When Jesus said she was asleep, he was referring to the sleep of the body which lies down in the grave, still and silent. The language of Christ here about death is not the language of the world about death. It's the language of the one who sees the eternal future of the soul. The world looks at death as the end. But the Bible makes it clear that death is not the end. The soul continues to exist either in heaven or in hell. Jesus was perfecting the imperfect faith of Jairus. And God will do his work in his time. And one can be amazed at how God works and the timing that he uses. Jesus' power eventually honors Jairus' developing patient faith. The timing may not have been what Jairus desired, but events were still in God's control through his agent. Others may have thought all was lost, and by all appearances, they were. Nevertheless, Jesus had and has the authority to reverse appearances and to render the delay meaningless. In verse 56, and her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Why not tell everybody? Why not announce this? Why keep this secret? Doesn't Jesus want people to know who he is? What he can do? The shorter answer, I think, is Jesus knows that he's headed for a different kind of ministry than people really want from him. The Jews, if they saw him as the Messiah, they saw him as this military and military, political, and religious leader who would drive out the Romans. It was an incorrect view of what the Messiah or who the Messiah was to be. And then his excessive focus on his works of power will undermine the type of commitment that he'll ask for the people. Many followed Jesus for selfish motives or were swept up in the excitement that his miracles inspired. He'd already explained that discipleship is costly. Citizenship in the kingdom of God calls for a radically countercultural thinking and behavior. It's very possible that Jesus wanted to de-emphasize the sensational in order to highlight the more sobering aspects of following him. I mean, it's easier to follow the guy who's raising the dead and healing people than to follow the guy who's telling you, in your life you're going to have tribulation. In your life it's not going to be easy. But I also think that Jesus was probably protecting this little girl from the perils of publicity. I mean, so much attention would be placed on the girl from the telling of this resurrection story. She'd be an instant celebrity. People can really be cruel. In John 12, verse 10, it says that when Lazarus was raised from the dead, knowledge of his resurrection inspired the enemies of Christ to want to kill Lazarus. Do you think it would have been any different for this little girl and her family? By not allowing a big deal to be made of this episode, Jesus is taking the spotlight off of the young girl and her family. Think about it this way. In this little episode, there are four people who Jesus is focusing on. Obviously, Jairus and his wife are there, but also everyone else is shut out from the girl's house except the three apostles, Peter, John, and James. And while Jesus performs miracles that many people witness and many people come to Jesus and believe in him and his work and the future he tells them about, the apostles at this point are really the people that Jesus was focused on. Everything he said and did from the time he identified, from the time he called out the 12 specifically, to the time he ascends to heaven after his resurrection, is intended to build them up. Yeah, he speaks to crowds, but he's not worried about the crowds. The focus are these 12 Jewish men. to prepare them for the time when he wouldn't be around. Ultimately, the message of Luke chapter 8 is this. Jesus is the hope of the hopeless. He showed this to his disciples when they thought they would die in a storm on the lake. To the demon-possessed man who couldn't be tamed. And the people turned around and said, "Get out. Leave us alone. We don't want any of that." And to the desperate woman who couldn't be cured. And to the father who lost all hope as he was told that he could no longer be helped because his daughter was dead. And the message is Jesus can do anything. Nothing is too great for him. He can save your soul. He can restore your life. Yes, even yours and mine. It's not recognizing. It's not recognizing your circumstances. It's recognizing. It's recognizing that you can't do anything about it. It's recognizing that your plan is the plan that got you into the situation you're in. And that Christ has a better plan for your life. And wanting that better plan. And wanting the future that he talks about. The future he has planned. And the hope that he provides for that future in him. Again, he can save your soul. He can restore your life. Is that what you're wanting? Do you really want that? Or do you just want to be able to say, "Yeah, I know Jesus. Yeah, I saw the tricks he did." What do you really want? Would you pray with me? I missed something because there's dead trees up here. Heavenly and gracious Father, if we're honest, we're all somewhere between Jairus and the woman who had been suffering for 12 years. Somewhere along the way, our faith started just like theirs. And as we've gotten older, hopefully we've grown a little bit more comfortable in our faith, a little bit more comfortable with you. And we see you not as a great miracle worker, but as the one who has changed our lives. And if that's truly the case, if you have truly changed our lives, then I would pray, Lord, that you would help us to live like it. You would help us to live like redeemed people who do have a hope for the future, who do have a sense of an understanding of who you are and that the promises you made will be fulfilled. And too often we run around like people who say we know Jesus and then live lives of desperation. And people see that, and they don't want that kind of Jesus. They want the Jesus that raises the dead and transforms lives. And I pray, Lord, that you could help us give them that Jesus, be ambassadors of that Jesus to the culture. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.